This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. There are loads of scary statistics out there showing just how few Americans are saving for retirement. For instance, more than half of all workers haven't bothered to figure out how much they'll need to retire comfortably. Today on Vermont Edition, we'll try to help you answer that question and give you some tips and strategies so that you can maximize your retirement savings. And if you haven't begun saving yet, we'll give you some advice on how to start. Ben Nostrand is my guest today. He's Chief Investment Officer at Westview Investment Advisors, which is in Burlington. Ben Nostrand, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess first question, what is the best way to determine how much you'll need for retirement? Is there a formula that people can use?
There's no formula. Everybody's actually quite different, as you know. But, you know, the one thing to do as you get into kind of the middle age years is to generate a financial plan. And the first thing in there is to do a budget and look at your yearly expenses. Many people don't realize exactly what they're paying for all the items during the year. And if you add that up and look at your yearly expenses, you might see that you have $400 in magazine subscriptions, which is – or you're paying $1,000 a month in clothing. And this can be a hinder for your retirement. The other thing in retirement is you want to look at your level of assets, your income and projected income, which includes Social Security, any pensions, and of course your investments. And then account for any events in the future such as home purchases and sales, health care, large purchases such as cars and other items. What we do is then we look at, put that all into a analysis and look at the options. If there's shortfalls, you might have to cut some expenses. Maybe you need to work more or work longer. And maybe if you're fortunate, you can retire right now. The thing to remember is retirement is not always mandatory. Some people aren't really comfortable once they retired. They may just end up wanting to make late changes in their career so that their retirement is put off and they can do something they enjoy into later years, which helps supplement their retirement savings.
Well, it's funny. I came across a statistic put out by the AARP saying 40% of baby boomers say they now plan to work until they die. 40%. Listeners, is that your plan? Are you just going to keep working, or are you on track with retirement savings? You can join our conversation today by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you've got a question about your 401k or your Roth account, or maybe you want to know more about long-term care insurance. Now's your chance to get those questions answered. And you can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So, you're talking about everybody being different, but I've seen some statistics out there showing that you need to save a certain number of, multiply your income, say, times 10 or 11 to come up with a ballpark figure of how much you'll need to save. Is there anything to those statistics that I've read?
There is. Those are some guidelines. There's dozens of them. Some people use – you can only take 4% withdrawal rate when you're in retirement. But we like to do a more thorough analysis and, do a custom analysis. We use something called a Monte Carlo simulation, which sounds like a little like gambling, but it's actually the opposite. It's a statistical program which helps identify various scenarios in the market, looks at up to 2,500 different scenarios, and looks at the worst-case scenario, which is always good to plan for. And, all the things I talked about before, income, expenses, assets, are plugged into this program. And as things change, it's important to, update that analysis at least once a year or in any, financial event that might happen. And it's good for people to pick a time. You can say, I'll do this next year. But if you use something like your birthday or, say, every Memorial Day, I'm going to review my retirement plan, that's very helpful to some.
Listeners, we're talking about retirement planning today. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. Ben Nostrand is one of my guests. I'd like to introduce my second guest now. Joe Little is also joining us. Joe Little is president and owner of Park Place Financial Advisors. That's a Brattleboro-based firm. Joe Little, welcome to Vermont Edition to you.
Oh, thank you, Nina.
So, you know, there are a lot of folks out there who are probably listening to this saying, you know, I haven't set that day on my calendar, you know, my birthday, say, to sit down with my spouse or by myself to start this whole process of retirement planning. What do you say to your clients? How do you encourage them to take that first step? Ben was talking about sort of listing out your assets and kind of figuring out what your budget is. Do you have any other tips that you give to people?
Well, I think that's really the place to start is to identify what you have right now and figure out what your expenses are. You know, people wait too long to start planning, and it's never too early. And people come in, and maybe they are starting their 50s, and they're feeling guilty about it. It isn't too early, and people need to get going and get moving on it. It's interesting. I find a lot of people don't know actually what they spend. They know what they earn, but they're not really clear on the details. And so, doing a budget is pretty important.
I find when I do that, I'm really turned off, and it's kind of depressing that when I really sit down and start listing all the expenses, I sort of turn my computer off and think, I'll come back to this next week. Right. So it's easy to, as you say, put that off. Jim from Burlington wrote in with data reported by the 2013 Ameriprise Retirement Check-In Survey, which found that many who responded are relying on the value of their house to help them with retirement. What he writes in, he says, is nearly half of respondents to the survey expect to use the equity in their home to help fund retirement. And Jim wants to know, how can one do this? Ben Nostrand, how much should people count on the value of their home?
We don't really recommend people use their home as a primary vehicle for your retirement plans. It's definitely one piece of the puzzle. You know, just as Social Security might provide only a quarter of your retirement income. A house is there for you to shelter you and have a place to live in. It's definitely an event that will happen at some point. You may sell that house and downsize, and therefore you might have some extra cash in your planning. But we don't recommend relying on your house by any means for retirement planning.
I was shocked that you just said Social Security should be considered as one quarter of your income. I came across a statistic that said about a third of Americans end up relying entirely on Social Security. Joe Little, how do you counsel people to work in Social Security into their whole financial planning process?
Well, it's an important piece. Ben's right. It really should only be about a quarter of your cash flow. But I think the study is correct, too, that a lot of people think it's going to carry them. It's not as much as you think. And, you know, it's a great resource. It will pay you you'll take your last breath. But you better really make sure you've got other assets available. And it also doesn't keep up pace with inflation. The increases in Social Security have historically are lower than the inflation rate. So you start falling behind almost immediately.
And I think one of the things that gets daunting when people start thinking about retirement planning is there are so many unknowns, namely the question of how long you're going to live, how many years do you need to plan for, not to mention rates of inflation and what the stock market is going to do. Joe Little, how do you try to juggle all of those uncertainties when coming up with a number?
You know, when you're doing retirement planning, there's really three key variables. And the other most of the other stuff are facts or knowns, and one being the rate of inflation, the second being your rate of return, and the third is life expectancy. And so when we do planning, you're really being as conservative as you can be, you know, not being aggressive in what you think the rate of return might be, reasonable maybe in the rate of inflation, and you know, assuming people are living longer, and the worst case scenario is to run out of money. So you usually try to, you can find out about people's family history and such. But those three key variables, the rate of return, the inflation rate, and life expectancy are sort of paramount to the entire plan.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about retirement planning and how to make sure you can stop working and stay comfortable in your later guests. My guests are Ben Nostrand. He's a chief investment officer at Westview Investment Advisors in Burlington, and Joe Little, president and owner of Park Place Financial Advisors, and that's a Brattleboro-based firm. Let me ask you, Ben Nostrand, when you have young people, say folks in their 20s, maybe their early 30s, and they're just starting to get their heads around the idea of saving for retirement, what sort of a strategy do you recommend they take? How do you start?
Start, for one. the earlier you start, the easier it is to reach your goals. Make those sacrifices if you have to. You'll be happier for it later down the road. you know, if I just used a simple 25-year-old example, if you contributed $381 a month starting at 25 years old by age 65 at 7% annual return, you'd reach $1 million. If you started at 45, you'd have to put in $1,920 a month.
Wow.
And you wouldn't be able to do that in all tax-deferred investments because you reach the limits. So the earlier you start, the better.
Listeners, 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call. If you have a question or a comment about retirement planning, you can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We were just talking about younger folks and how they can plan for retirement. Joe Little, how does that strategy change when you're in your 40s and 50s? Maybe you've already started a retirement plan. Do you need to start tweaking it at that point?
You should be tweaking it all the time. And I think a lot of the listeners will find they're dealing with sort of dual challenges. A lot of people have kids to put through college, and they're also trying to save for retirement. So it does get complicated. You do have to keep tweaking it, though.
And what do you mean by tweaking it? When you're looking at your portfolio, if you have one, what are the things that you need to be thinking about in your 40s and 50s?
Well, I mean, I think you're always trying to make sure that you've got a portfolio that matches the risk that you're comfortable with. And so, you know, you may get, as you get older, you may become less risk tolerant. You may need to reduce the amount of risk in the portfolio. The other is to just make sure you're putting enough in. You know, we often suggest that when people get a raise, consider putting half of it into your 401 and taking the other half home. That way you're always adding or always increasing the amount you're deferring.
And I've also heard people suggest that when you finally pay off that car, keep making the car payments to that retirement account or the college savings fund or whatever that your goal is.
Yeah, any strategy like that is effective.
So, Ben Nostrand, for people who don't have a retirement program like a 401k with their job and have to invest on their own, I think many people turn to mutual funds, but I know that when I've looked up mutual funds, many, if not most of them, have a minimum initial investment of maybe $1,000 to $5,000. That's what you need to get yourself in. And I'm wondering how often that can be an obstacle and if there are less costly funds now out there that people can at least start with. So even someone that wants to just start saving, say, $25 a month can do it. Are those funds available?
They are. As far as mutual funds go, you're right, Nina, that there are some with minimums. There are some with no minimums, though. But you can also use exchange-traded funds, which you can buy on the market, and there are no minimums on those. And you can start with, if you're doing $25 a month, you can start investing in, say, a S&P 500 exchange-traded fund.
What is an exchange-traded fund? I haven't heard that term.
Yeah, it's a mutual fund that's traded on the stock exchange like a stock. So when you buy it at 1 o'clock or 2 minutes after 1, you're getting that – it's settling right there. Whereas a mutual fund, you wait overnight. It's also typically a index fund. So what you're getting is if you invest in the the Vanguard S&P 500 index fund, for example, you're getting – the S&P 500. So you're getting the market.
Hmm. Carl posted on Facebook, I am 62 and plan on retiring at 70. How do I account for inflation if Social Security does not keep up? Is there a figure I can use as a multiplier to get an estimate of what I need each year over my life expectancy? Joe Little, can you take a stab at that?
Well, that's one of those unknowns. So as far as making an estimate, you know, if you looked at the 30-year average going backwards, it's in the 4% range. I think it's around 4.3%. So you can either use a figure like that, which would be a conservative figure. A lot of the plans that we're doing now going forward, we're using a 3% average inflation factor. And again, that might be a tweak later on, but it's certainly a place to start.
1-800-639-2211 is the number to call if you have a question or a comment about retirement planning, rather. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Brattleboro now and take a call from Micah. Hi, Micah. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question today is maybe a little bit different than most that might come in. I'm a young, disabled person. I'm in my 30s, and I'm blind. And what I'm wondering is, are there government provisions or permissions pertaining to the idea of saving for retirement for folks like myself who are already on a limited income that is provided by the government, and it's, you know, it's not necessarily a lot, as you pointed out before.
Interesting question. Ben Nostrand, what about using disability to factor into retirement?
Well, for special needs cases, there's always, you know, tax credits, breaks, it's just another factor that we'd have to put into a retirement plan. Offhand, I don't know the specific rules on those types of things, but it's obviously it requires a lot more expenses, and you'd have to plan for that.
Joe Little, did you have anything to add to the comment about disability?
No, I don't. I'm not aware of any special programs that would apply to the caller.
All right. We'll take more of your calls. Again, our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on Vermont Edition's Facebook page, and we'll get to more of your calls. Take more of your questions when we come back. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and today we're answering your questions about retirement planning with financial planners Joe Little and Ben Nostrand. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. David in Jericho emailed in this comment: for higher income earners with access to a Roth 403b through their employer, does it make sense to split retirement contributions between Roth and non-Roth options? Joe Little, do you have any insight for David?
I think that I like having a lot of sort of buckets to take money out of in retirement. And so if all of my money is in a 403b, a traditional or a typical 403b, everything's going to be taxable when it comes out. If some of it's in a Roth 403b, then I'm going to have an option of maybe I don't want to incur some tax one particular year and I'll want to take it from the Roth. So I think in general it's a good idea. Admittedly, you give up the tax break by going into the Roth, but it's good to have multiple sort of places to take money from in retirement.
And do you want to just explain for listeners what the difference between those types of funds are?
It's really just the way the IRS treats them in a typical a 401k or a 403b, which are basically the same thing. When you put money in, you get a tax break with the money going into the account. When it comes out in retirement, you have to pay taxes on it, all of it. If it grew, if it doubled, you'd have to pay tax on the everything you take out. In a Roth, you don't get a tax deduction for putting the money in. So you're really using after-tax dollars. But when it comes out, it comes out tax-free. You don't owe anything, even if it has doubled or tripled or anything. You're paying nothing on the income tax side. So it's definitely, you know, it's an advantage if you're willing to give up the tax break going in.
All right. Well, let's go to the phone lines now. Let's take a call from Plattsburgh. Roy's calling in. Hi, Roy. You're on the air.
Yeah, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Go ahead.
Yeah, I occasionally purchase and sell mutual funds, probably through the largest mutual fund company out there, I think. And whenever I seem to buy funds and the market seems to go up over a couple of days. You know, it doesn't seem that my trade goes through for a couple of days after it reaches its peak. And as an example, earlier this year, I sold the mutual fund and ended up on the losing side by the timing. And then recently purchased the exact same fund, and it traded at a different time and ended up on the losing side again, even though the market shifted. I don't know if there's rules and regulations about that, and who enforces that sort of stuff.
Well, let me throw that question to Ben Nostrand. What about that, delays and the timing of your purchase of mutual funds?
Well, that's the difference I was talking about before between mutual funds and exchange-traded funds. With an exchange-traded fund, you're getting the price that's published or online at that moment. With a mutual fund, if you purchase by 4 p.m. today, they will reprice that fund depending on what the market did today, and then you'll get that price after that fund is repriced. So in the morning, when you check your holdings, you should have that fund. If you don't, then I would say something's wrong. As far as settlement, some funds settle the next day in terms of payment, and sometimes up to 3 days.
Interesting. Well, thanks for that call. Let's go take another call now. Let's talk to Rob, who's calling from New York. Hi, Rob. You're on the program. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, thanks. I don't mean to pour cold water on anybody, but I feel like this is sort of dabbling in the dark art. Life is what happens, you know, when you're making other plans. And stockbrokers and these people that are your guests, they make their living telling us what to do. And in fact, they don't have crystal balls. And big changes can happen in an instant. So I think the best advice is just save your money. And just save your money, period.
All right, Rob, thanks for your call. Joe Little, let me ask you, there are some folks out there that think, a financial planner is taking too much of their returns. How do you defend why it's important to hire someone to be a financial planner?
Well, you know, it's not for everybody. Everyone doesn't necessarily need one. The caller doesn't need one. He's right in saying that there's certainly a lot that can go on in your life, and we don't have a crystal ball. But, you know, not having any kind of plan, a lot of people, you know, need some help. They need the advice to actually carry through and to sort of have a plan of some type. And I think it becomes – I think it's worthwhile, but that's me saying that. I think it's good to have – you know, everyone needs guidance, and that's essentially what we provide.
All right. Let's take another –
If I may add to that too.
Absolutely, Ben. Go ahead.
Rob was correct in that savings is much more important than the investment returns in reaching your long-term goals. That's why it's so important as part of a plan to maintain a savings strategy. And the best way you can do that would be to continually take out of your paycheck a monthly amount. Pay yourself, basically, before you pay all of your other expenses. And the other thing that I would say to Rob is that a well-diversified portfolio can protect against some of those downturns. You're not going to escape completely, but you can soften some of the volatility of the market with a well-diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds.
Let's take a call now from Williston. Peggy is on the line. Hi, Peggy. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Yeah, good morning. I'm on my cell phone at the gym, so I hope you can hear me.
We can. Go ahead.
Okay, in 1980, I was basically broke. I was 45 years old. I moved to Vermont from North Dakota, didn't have much. And now I'm worth over $1 million. And I've done that not by my own.
Peggy, are you there?
By portfolio, yes.
We lost a couple of your, go ahead.
Okay, I've managed to have a pretty reasonable retirement by being diverse, a lot of diversity, and that was the I wanted to have your guys discuss was don't put all your money in the stock market. try to do something more diverse. I have IRAs. I have a Kraft retirement plan. I own a car.
Peggy, you're breaking up, but I get the gist of your comment, and Ben was just talking about that. Joe Little, talk about how people can ensure that whatever savings program they have for retirement is a diverse one.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, looking at what investments that you have, being both in the bond market and the stock market, you know, being in, then there's a wide variety of types of investments and growth investments and value investments.
Bonds being more conservative and stocks being more volatile.
That's right. And, you know, but you're really looking for investments that don't correlate to each other. I mean, and which really just means I want to make sure that I have enough things that if the market goes down, I have things that may be going up or at least staying the same. If everything is correlated, then when everything goes down, everything goes down. And so, you know, people mentioned real estate, and real estate's another good hedge. It's sort of fairly level, fairly flat. It doesn't change that much. And so that's, you know, that is not necessarily directly correlated to either the bond market or the stock market. So I think diversification is important.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about retirement planning with two financial experts. They're giving us their take on it. If you have a question, you can call us at 1-800-639-2211 or head over to the website, VPR's website, vpr.net, and hit the Vermont Edition button. Elizabeth just emailed this question. I have a significant amount of student loans after getting my master's degree. I'm about to start a new job with a 401k option, and I'm not sure how to proceed. Do I save now or pay toward my loans? Ben Nostrand, what do you suggest to Elizabeth?
Well, you have to make the payments on the loans, as we know, but it is important to start saving in that 401k plan. We typically recommend people save 10 to 15% if they can, but you may have to adjust, Elizabeth, due to the fact that you do have those loans. So, but the more you save now, the better you'll be in the future. And there's probably a lot of student loans, but you know, at some point, your income may grow, and you'll be able to pay those off more quickly.
One thing we haven't talked about is healthcare issues that come up later in life. And I know a question that my friends and I are often asking each other is, you know, who's got long-term care insurance? Who's thinking of getting it? Ben Nostrand, what's your advice to people considering long-term care insurance? Do you think it's a good idea?
It really depends on your asset level, primarily. You know, for some, they can self-insure. When you get down into a lower level of assets, they might need to buy long-term care insurance. And in that case, you need to look at the quality of the insurer, the inflation riders, and the ability for you to pay premiums all the way into the future. The last thing you want to do is pay premiums, and then when you get to 70, you run out of money to pay those premiums, and you've wasted all that money where you could have self-insured yourself.
Hmm.
And if you know, long-term care insurance is expensive, and you should get it in your lower 50s. Otherwise, it gets prohibitively expensive as you start to get into your 60s. The other thing is, they can actually bump premiums sometimes. So it's not like life insurance where you have a guaranteed premium 20 years out.
So a lot to consider.
Yes.
Well, let's go to Morrisville. We can get a couple more calls in. Let's talk with Raman. Hi, Raman. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. I'd just like to know if your guests are certified, like have a CFP or CFA, so that people can trust them more.
Well, let me ask Joe Little. Talk about your credentials.
I'm a CPA and a CFP.
And Ben, how about you?
I'm a CFP as well.
And that's a certified financial planner.
Correct. And that is a distinction issued by the Certified Financial Planning Board of Standards. And it's issued to those who attain certain levels of education, experience, ethics, as well as take a rigorous exam.
Well, Raman brings up an interesting question. Joe Little, let me ask you, when someone is considering hiring a financial planner, how do you ensure that you have someone with the right credentials, and how do you find someone who you can count on that way?
There are resources. You can go to the Certified Financial Planning Board site or the Financial Planning Association site, and you can find out planners that are in your area. You can see their credentials. As well, if it's a broker, there's also there are sites. FINRA has a site where you can actually check a stock broker to see if there's any problems against their license.
All right.
I want to add one thing before we go, and that was that on the healthcare issue, and Peg was calling from the gym. Healthcare could be the most expensive thing in retirement. One of the things people can really do for themselves is, and it sounds crazy, but stay healthy. You know, go to the gym. I'm not a fitness nut, but I think that trying to stay reasonably healthy can save you tens of thousands of dollars as you get older.
I saw statistics that back that up. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and it's, everybody can do it. I mean, well, I say that, and not everybody can do it, and I don't want those people calling me. But
well, even if people can't save for retirement, they can probably find a little time to take a walk around their neighborhood or head to the gym. We're going to have to end on that note. Joe Little is president and owner of Park Place Financial Advisors in Brattleboro. Ben Nostrand is chief investment officer at Westview Investment Advisors in Burlington. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nina.
And listeners, you can continue this discussion online at vpr.net. Still to come, we'll talk with a UVM history professor about the college's first African-American graduate. Andrew Harris got his degree at UVM in 1838, at a time when most U.S. colleges wouldn't admit black students. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. In the early 1800s, African-American college graduates were quite rare. Most people in Vermont point to Middlebury's Alexander Twilight as the exception. But very few people know the story of the University of Vermont's first black graduate, Andrew Harris. VPR's Rick Singeri recently sat down with UVM history professor Kevin Thornton to learn more about Harris.
Kevin, tell us a bit about this man and how he got to UVM.
Well, he was from upstate New York. He was born in the Finger Lakes region. We know very little about his birth because black births weren't tracked very effectively in New York. And he got an education. He was apparently raised in a white family, in a Presbyterian household. His stepfather was a minister. He's very devout. And this is the period when the Second Great Awakening is happening in New York. So there's a lot of religious excitement. And that religious excitement is also tied to reform. So Harris grows up in this devout household that's probably very concerned with reform. He's obviously interested in race. And he gets an education. He attends the Geneva Lyceum probably. And then decides he wants to attend college. And he makes his way down the Erie Canal. The canal system's opened up transportation. It's also opened up the transmission of ideas in America across the Northeast. And Burlington's part of that system. Burlington's the Northeast terminus of the Erie Canal system. So first he goes to Troy. There's a small black community in Troy. He establishes himself there, decides he wants to go to college. He applies to Union College in Schenectady, which makes perfect sense. It's the nearest college. Gets rejected. And then I think he moves up the Erie Canal system or the Champlain Canal system through Lake Champlain. Apparently he tries to gain admission at Middlebury College. He's again rejected. And UVM's the end of the line. There's no other college. And he comes to UVM and he is admitted at UVM.
What does he major in? What does he study here?
There's no major in those days. Everybody studies the same thing. It's mainly Latin and Greek authors, you know, Livy, Tacitus, things like that. A lot of that in the first 2 years. And then there's a certain amount of math, conic sections. And then there are more, I guess, electives. It wouldn't really be elective. There are other required courses in the third and fourth year that are a little more diverse.
How was Andrew Harris treated when he was a student at UVM?
Not very well. Harris was admitted by President Wheeler, who was a colonizationist. So Wheeler admits Harris, and it's apparently his decision. I've read the faculty minutes from the 1830s. He's just not in there. They're mostly concerned with disciplined students getting drunk and things like that. So Wheeler admits him, and the students promptly declare that they will not attend classes with Harris. And Wheeler apparently squelched that and said, you will or you won't go to class, which was very brave of him because there's only 24 members in Harris's class, including Harris. So he becomes a UVM student. One interesting thing about it is that in the transcripts, the grades are all listed. Because there are only 24 of them and they all took the same tests, the grades are all listed in a single page for every semester. And Harris is always – they're always in alphabetical order, but Harris is always listed last until the second set of exams his senior year. He finally is in the correct position in alphabetical order. And then when he graduates in 1838, the students – all of whom had to know him very well by then because there are only 24 members of the class, they refused to attend graduation with him. And they told the administration that if he was allowed to speak, every student gave an oration in those days, if he were allowed to speak and if he were allowed to receive his degree on the stage, that they would not participate. And the administration caved in and he had to sit off by himself during the whole graduation ceremony at UVM. So he had an uphill climb at UVM from start to finish, and he was never accepted, and it must have been very difficult for him.
Was he a good student?
He was 14th in a class of 24.
So what really set this man apart, Andrew Harris, from other black college graduates of his time?
He graduates in 1838, and he is the first to be an ardent abolitionist instead of a colonizationist. He's somebody who believes not only that slavery should end, but that there should be equality in America, that slavery is an American crime, and that deportation shouldn't occur, that ex-slaves shouldn't be deported, that they should become citizens of the United States.
What is a colonizationist?
Colonizationists believed, and this colonizationism kind of precedes hardcore abolitionism among whites certainly. Colonizationists believed that slavery was wrong and that it was immoral and Christian, but that there could not be a successful biracial society in America, that you couldn't have racial egalitarianism. You couldn't have democracy with both races. So the only solution to end slavery is also to get rid of black people. And therefore to send them to Africa. So Liberia is an American colony that begins because of the colonization movement.
And as an abolitionist, was he very outspoken? What did he do to further that cause?
He's a real product of a developing black middle class. He's an agent for a newspaper called The Colored American, which was a black-owned, black-published paper. It's anti-slavery. He joined the American Anti-Slavery Society. When he lived in Philadelphia, he joined the Eastern Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society. He was a member of something called the Levitt Anti-Slavery Society, which was a black working man's anti-slavery society. He's very active. He's one of the founders of the American and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society in 1840. He is a member of the Liberty Party, goes to the nominating convention in 1840 for the Liberty Party. So he's as active as he can be. He's part of the New York Vigilance Committee, which was a committee that aided runaway slaves. And he's a member of that I don't know what year he joins, but he's a member of that in 1840. So he is joining everything he can. He's as active as he can. He's outspoken. He speaks at the American Anti-Slavery Society Convention in 1839.
But Kevin, this is the 1830s and 1840s. What kind of courage must this man have had to be outspoken about slavery and racism at that time?
Well, you had to have a lot of physical courage. That abolition speakers were attacked. I mean, they're attacked in Vermont, white ones. It's dangerous. Where he lived in Philadelphia, there were race riots in 1834, 1835, 1838. There's a big anti-abolitionist riot in 1838 where the abolitionists had built a meeting hall. It was 3 weeks old and it was burnt to the ground. There's another riot in 1842, and there's another one in 1849. And the black neighborhood in Philadelphia is very small. That Harris was the pastor by then of a church on St. Mary Street. St. Mary Street was only two blocks long, and it's attacked in every one of these riots. So his church was burnt in 1842. It's very dangerous. And to be outspoken is to make yourself a target. To be a middle-class black person was to be a target anyway because the rioters tend to be working-class whites, often Irish. So they would resent someone like that. And Harris is actually mocked for his speech to the American Anti-Slavery Society in a Philadelphia newspaper. So he made himself a target, and at a time where to stick out in that way was physically dangerous.
Explain the development of the black middle class at this time.
Well, he's a really good example. The black middle class is just forming. And the black middle class is in this position where they're very patriotic. They're very committed to the American ideals of liberty and democracy. They just want them expanded. At the same time, they're very aware, obviously, of racism. They want to be examples of upward mobility. They want to succeed in life. They want equality. So they're simultaneously very, very average Americans and very resistant to the conditions of American life, specifically racism. So in that sense, they're radical. It's radical to be a Democrat who wants a racially egalitarian society in those days.
How has UVM remembered its first African-American graduate?
UVM hasn't remembered him at all. He was rediscovered a couple of years ago. Jeff Marshall, the special collections librarian, made it known that we had this earlier black graduate than had previously been thought. And UVM has made no effort to commemorate him in any way.
Are there any plans to rectify that at this time?
As far as I know, there aren't. I haven't been able to get my emails answered from anyone in the administration about it. I'm trying to make it known. I'm trying to get some students involved in pushing for this. Some of them are interested. It's all in the early stages, but nothing so far.
Kevin Thornton is a professor of history at UVM. We have a link with more information about Andrew Harris at our website, vpr.net. And now we turn to some of the messages you've sent in to us. Vermont Edition producer Rick Singeri joins me in the studio to read what you've had to say about recent programs. Hi, Rick.
Hey there, Nina. So last Thursday, we had a discussion on sustainable communities with Bruce Seifer, one of the authors of a new book on the subject. He's also led Burlington's economic development efforts for 30 years. And Connie commented, many thanks to Bruce Seifer, CETO, Mayors Peter Clavel and Bernie Sanders, and many others for their work in creating the thriving community that Burlington is. National leaders in the community economic development field look to Burlington as a model of sustainable development success.
When we discussed butchering with Cole Ward last week, Irene from Middlebury related this humorous story. She says this incident took place at a visit to the local butcher shop in Marshfield, Wisconsin, back in about 1970. The display case held the fresh meats, sausages, and always two fresh whole chickens front and center. We were regular customers, so my daughter knew the butcher by name, and she said, looking at the two birds in the case, Mr. Pilsner, haven't you sold those two chickens yet?
Monday, when we discussed custody issues, we heard from quite a few listeners. Jacqueline was one, and she wrote, I don't believe anyone is surprised that a divorcing couple may not get along. However, the current custody law enables the one parent most frequently seen pushing the stroller to refuse joint custody and gain full custody for no reason at all. This law favors adults acting like children versus favoring the best interests of the actual children. Vermont should recognize that the assessment of a good parent goes far beyond the pushing of a stroller.
Chris offered this. The guests did a reasonable job of describing how the court system works in theory, but spent little time discussing the gross misuse of our legal system by parents fighting over their children. Our statutes are supposed to protect the best interests of the children, but our courts lack a key tool in being able to do this by granting shared custody when they see that it is in the best interest of a child. My ex-wife and I are living proof that people can get through an ugly divorce and still co-parent effectively.
And Kim wrote, I find that when facing divorce with children, men most often bring up money as the first concern, whereas women's focus is the welfare of the children. I have seen women offer joint custody and men refuse, insisting on pursuing the divorce in an angry, vindictive manner. It is well recognized by those who work in mental health and counseling that men often use the custody issue as a way to get back at the spouse, no matter who initiated the divorce.
Tuesday, we discussed a bill that has passed the House and is in the Senate now that would ban the use of handheld devices while driving. Lil Ski says it might interest folks to read the actual statistics. Even the Governor's Highway and Safety Association shows that better enforcement is needed for the existing texting law, not necessarily a total ban, which would be no better than enforcement than enforcing the current law. I know we all have anecdotal stories to share, but wouldn't it serve Vermonters better to enact laws that make a difference instead of relying on legislators' notions?
And Concerned in New Hampshire made this point: I encounter too many drivers who are looking down rather than ahead where they should be. That's both youth and adult. It could be enforced with an officer on foot who could easily see the infraction. Sometimes the drivers aren't looking up for 5 to 15 seconds at a time.
We always welcome your questions, concerns, and comments about the show. Send your emails to vermontedition@vpr.net or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Thanks, Rick.
You're most welcome, Nina.
And that's it for today's show. Tomorrow, lawmakers are looking at changes to the education property tax, the income tax, and the governor's plan to expand a tax on health care premiums. Bob Kinzel will talk with two key committee chairs from the House and Senate about what these changes could mean for Vermonters. Listen for that tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Patty Daniels, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. From PEG TV Studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.